want to repeat, I'd like to thank my two lawyers. Without them, I wouldn't be here now. And I'd like to thank the U.S. Marshal Service for treating me great.
And now I think Mr. Acero intends to go home and spend Thanksgiving with his family.
I got 2 years here, and I'm dying to get home.
Mr. Acero,
let's go.
Former Kansas City Police Department intelligence detective and now attorney Gary Jenkins produced 4 documentary films, most recently Gangland Wire, creator of smartphone app entitled Kansas City Mob Tours. Download it now. If you like what you hear, go to ganglandwire.com. Navigate to the shop page. We need you to put a hit out on our donate button. Gangland Wire True Crime Stories is produced at the Big Dumb Fun Show Studio 4. And now, here's Gary Jenkins.
Welcome, folks. Tonight we have it's going to be a little bit different. This is not the regular sound. You might notice this is not the Big Dumb Fun Show Studio sound. This is my in-home studio sound because I wanted to maximize my time and I add some more interviews in for your guys' listening pleasure, shall we say. And you know I'm doing this Media and the Mob Mondays, and every Monday we're having a different reporter talk about their experiences in reporting on the mob. And tonight we have my good friend and cohort, Scott Bernstein from Detroit. Welcome, Scott.
Thanks, Gary, man. Appreciate it. Love what you guys do. And appreciated all of our past interactions and all your knowledge, and love to share my knowledge with you and your audience.
Oh, great. Interested in the Mafia or La Cosa Nostra, or I think in, they call it the combination maybe in Chicago, or in Detroit, or the partnership Detroit. In Detroit.
Yeah.
So how did you get into this business?
Well, it's actually it's a long story, but I'll shorten it for you. So I have a lot of family connections to the underworld in Detroit, getting back to Prohibition. My great grandfather's first cousins were the infamous Bernstein brothers, Abe, Joe, Ray, and Izzy Bernstein, who were the founders and bosses of the Purple Gang, which is the most iconic underworld group in Detroit history, and definitely one of the more iconic underworld syndicates in American history. And they controlled a big chunk of all the bootlegging industry in the Midwest, and made quite a name for themselves, both for their ability to make money and the Purple Gang in general, not necessarily my cousin, for their ability to make money and murder a lot of people. their body count was quite prolific. And then I have a number of other kind of loose connections through family members that were married to people, or my grandpa used to kind of run with a fast crowd. I wouldn't call my grandpa a gangster by any means, but he had friends that were gangsters. And
you probably had some friends that are gangsters yourself. I know I do.
Now I do, but not when I was younger.
Okay.
So I kind of was exposed to it a little bit, in addition to the family history, just kind of running around with my grandfather's friends as a teenager. But really, that's not what got me interested in it. Everyone kind of assumes that's what got me interested in it, the family history and like I said, some of my grandpa's connections. But it really was when I was in law school. I went to law school in Chicago, and I interned at the Illinois Attorney General's office. I went to law school at John Marshall Law School in Chicago. I interned at the Attorney General's office under a guy named Jim Ryan, who was the Attorney General at the time. And I was assigned to work Chicago outfit mob cases with the lawyers that I was working with, the prosecutors that I was working with. And I actually got to go out, and the Attorney General's office had a division of the Cook County Sheriff's Department that they worked with, and I got to actually go out with Cook County sheriffs and go interview witnesses and mob associates and some mobsters and sit in some trials and help build some cases. That really piqued my interest. It got me wondering about where I grew up and the mob in Detroit, and you know, more so than just the kind of cursory knowledge that I had, like I said, from my family. And even wondering, hanging out with my grandpa at that point, I knew that his friends were connected and his friends did business with these guys, but I didn't know their names. I didn't know their stories. I mean, I knew my grandpa's friends' names, but I didn't know the guys they were connected with names, and then it just got me digging. And I started to dig around, and I was lucky that, I was lucky in two different aspects. I was lucky because I had a professor in law school that had been published before and kind of pushed me towards starting to write about the mob and reporting about the mob, because he saw my interest in it and knew that I didn't want to really practice law. And then just my fortunate for me, I came into an area in Detroit that, despite the fact that it has this incredibly rich, layered, complex, and fascinating mob history and you know, Jimmy Hoffa and the Purple Gang and Las Vegas and the Teamsters and even up until today, despite the fact that that all exists, there was very little written about it. So I had a kind of a bear market to come in and mine for material, and it boded well when a young, eager, ambitious 28-year-old, 29-year-old Scott Bernstein went to a book company and said, "Let me write a book about the Detroit mob." I think it helped that I had this professor that had published with them before championing me, and then it also helped when they looked at the literary landscape and they realized that there was nothing really there. So those two things came together and got me started in this field. And my first, I got my book deal in 2005, and my first book was published at the very end of 2006, early 2007, called Motor City Mafia, The History of Organized Crime in Detroit. And that just kind of got me off and running.
Well, interesting that I didn't really realize you went to law school. You know, we've talked several times, and I knew you have some incredible sources up there. And I remember, I think the first time that I stumbled across your blog site there, I was researching something about Kansas City, and there you've got information in there. It's like, oh my God, how did he know that up there? It was like this real personal information.
Yeah.
And we ended up talking, I think, shortly after that. So you've really got good sources. So tell us a little bit about, you know, how you develop sources. Or you know people personally, you know businessmen, I assume, and you probably got like deep background sources that you never want to reveal. Tell us a little bit about your developing sources.
Well, I've noticed that, first I'll say that some of my mentors in the business of mob reporting, two guys I'll mention, George Anastasia, who's a New York Times bestselling writer out of Philadelphia, and Dan Maldea, who's a New York Times bestseller, based out of Washington, D.C., but he did all the seminal Jimmy Hoffa research. And they both told me that it's probably the best that I hadn't gone to journalism school, because some of the stuff they teach you in journalism school doesn't really apply to mob reporting. You got to kind of throw some of the textbook stuff out of the way, or to the wayside. And you got to be able to wade in the dirt and really dig your heels in. And that doesn't mean compromising yourself, but it means showing both, I think, ex-members of law enforcement and current members of law enforcement, as well as ex-members of the mob and current members of the mob, that you're willing to get out behind your computer, get out from behind your notebook, and really engage. And when it comes to the underworld figures, that means something to them. And sometimes you have to socialize, but you gotta you always have to keep have certain lines that you won't cross. But at the same time, you gotta be willing to go sit with them and not act like you're afraid of them. And they respect that. And if you sit there and tell them what, you know, for the most part, not everybody, but if you tell them what you're there for and what you're doing, and that you wanna, you want their story, you know, you're gonna give their story and their the information they want to share with you, or if they want to share with you, the same way as you would give an FBI agent, the same way you would give a U.S. prosecutor, and you want to get the story from them, you're open to listening if you got something wrong, that, you know, you really value their information and their opinions. And I've noticed that it works. People are afraid of what they don't know and what they don't understand and what they can't see. And I've had a number of interactions with, like I said, both current mobsters and guys that were ex-mobsters that had a certain impression of me beforehand. And then when I sat down with them and, you know, had a drink with them or had lunch with them, went to the driving range with them, what have you, they came away with a different opinion. Now, you're not that bad of a guy. You know, you're not just out here to slam me or be a mouthpiece for the FBI. I think a lot of wise guys that read reporting, they just want to make this a reporter, like, you know, these almost fronts for the FBI, like an FBI propaganda machine of some sort. And when you show them that, like I said, you want to get their story out just as much as you would value an FBI agent telling you something, there's a level of respect there. But I've also learned that it's a domino effect. You get, and this is regarding both sources in current law enforcement and former law enforcement, and as I keep on repeating myself, current mob guys and ex-mob guys. If you meet one, or if you meet a couple good ones, they'll vouch for you with their friends, and then it kind of flows from there. The first source I ever made in my reporting was a former, correct me if I'm wrong, Gary, but they call them SACs.
Yeah, Special Agent in Charge, the SAC,
yeah,
for the FBI, yeah.
Right.
Special Agent in Charge, right.
A contact of my father's. My father's an attorney. My father was friends with a former U.S. prosecutor that had prosecuted mob cases, and he actually has a feather in his cap that he's the only prosecutor to ever convict Tony Giacalone, who was the face of the Detroit mob for 50, 60 years, and the number one suspect in the Jimmy Hoffa murder. He's sent to jail for 7 years on extortion and tax evasion. And a guy by the name of Richard Zuckerman, who's now in private practice. And Richard connected me to the former SAC of the Detroit FBI office, a guy by the name of Oscar Westerfield, who ran the Detroit Organized Crime Squad from 74 to 85, I believe, and then went on to run the Tampa, the Trafficante family outfit out in Florida, from the law enforcement, not actually running the mafia.
Yeah.
So I met Oscar, and Oscar introduced me connected me with his top mob getters, his top watchdogs. And these guys were all recently retired from the FBI at that point in the mid-2000s, and had gone to work in private security for some of the big three automakers here in Detroit. Those three guys just opened up the world to me. You know, they met with them a handful of times. They learned that I was on the up and up, and someone that they respected and got along with. And they introduced me to some of their friends. And those guys introduced me to some of their friends. Ended up going whenever there would be a FBI agent retirement party in the Detroit office. Because these guys can't really, you know, if they're going to talk to you on the job, it's got to be very, very off the record and very, very, you know, they have to be careful.
Yeah, I understand. Yes, I understand.
So, and frankly, it's, you know, kind of few and far between when these guys are in the office, unless they're really wanting to tip you off with something. But once they retire, you know, it's open season, and they can tell you really, as long as it's not an open investigation or, you know, some other possible sensitive, you know, extra sensitive information, they can really tell you anything they want about their time. So I ended up being invited to a lot of, whenever a new FBI agent would retire from the Detroit office, they would have a big party and all the ex-FBI agents would go, and they would invite me, and then I get to develop more sources. And then kind of the same thing happened with a lot of the wise guys that I interact with and have developed as sources, is, you know, you have one good relationship, or you're able to develop a trust with one or two of them, and just like it's human nature, you know, they have friends and they have cell phones, they have emails, you know, a lot of those guys will vouch for me for other guys, and said, you know, hey, this guy will do you right, you know, he'll treat you right, he's not gonna throw you under the bus, and he'll if you want to keep your identity confidential, and everything will be above board with him. And it's just, like I said, just like with the FBI agents, one led to another, which led to another, which led to another. Some of it, you know, with the wise guys is a little bit, you know, more prickly, obviously, because you're dealing with criminals. But I do know, just to give you an example, you know, the perspective that some of these guys have and how I think they kind of respect my willingness to, you know, interact with them more than just a phone call or more than just a 5-minute interview. Like, I'll go sit with these guys for 2-3 hours at the bar or at their social club, or, at a time, you know, to show them that I'm, you know, invested. And some of it, you just got to sit there and bullshit. You got to show them that you're not just there to, you know, it's human nature. I mean, they might view you in some ways as almost as a friend in a certain way. You always gotta, like I said, you always gotta keep that barrier and know that, you know, these guys are killers. These guys are, you know, at the core, they're hardcore criminals. But, you know, they're people, and if you can sit there and bullshit with them, that gets them more comfortable. Especially if you're bullshitting at a bar and they're taking back their favorite drink. Sometimes they loosen up as the night goes on.
Yeah, really. You know, I sent out word to a couple of Bob guys once through a mutual friend, and I told them what I was doing, and I wanted to talk to them about stuff that was, everybody was long gone. They were convicted. It was out of the 70s, but everybody was, the whole deal was gone, and, you know, it was the skimming from Las Vegas, and these were younger guys back then, and the only word they sent back was, oh yeah, he's looking for a snitch. So didn't work for me. But I also, being ex-law enforcement, and they were, I told my friend, I said, you make sure they know I used to be a cop. I don't want to put you in a pickle here. But I understand that they're real careful with who they talk to, and you got to prove yourself up. Now, let's talk a little bit, like, about the more, like, the 70s. It was almost like the peak of the mob in the Midwest was the 70s and all the casino money. And so as you are exploring that with people who are, you know, were alive today, but yet they're talking about, you know, somebody that they knew personally, and not real old stuff and old, you know, stories.
Well, I got...
You got some stories on that? That can get a little bit dicey sometimes.
Yeah, well, in terms of the Las Vegas angle and the Jimmy Hoffa angle, which is tied into the Las Vegas angle, because as people probably know, Jimmy Hoffa was president of the Teamsters Union, and the Teamsters Union pension fund is what really built Las Vegas into what it became. And it was kind of a quid pro quo with Jimmy Hoffa and his associates in the underworld, that he would, you know, they would give him muscle and support in the Teamsters ranks, and he would open up the Teamsters pension fund for kind of their own personal bank. I was fortunate enough to spend big portions of time in the last year of his life with Anthony Zerilli, Tony Z, who was the longtime underboss of the Detroit Mafia, and was also the acting boss for a time period between 1965 and 72, and then was the underboss between 78 and when he in the early 2000s when he was demoted. He died in 2015. But in addition to being very high up in the national mob landscape, he was also the first mobster, first major mobster to be indicted for skimming casinos. He was indicted in for skimming $6 million out of the Frontier. And the Detroit Mafia controlled three different casinos in Vegas. First, they controlled the Frontier until that bust. Then they took over the Aladdin until they were busted for skimming that casino in the late 70s, early 80s. Then they turned their attention to Laughlin, Nevada, and controlled a casino named called the Edgewater. But I got to actually spend, you know, I'd say over 100 hours with Tony Cirilli at the end of his life, and no one, very few people had risen as high as he had. And his dad, he was a mob prince as well. His dad was Joe Cirilli, who was the godfather of the Detroit mob for 41 years and a member of the commission, one of the most highly respected American mobsters of the 20th century. So this guy had seen it all. He was married to Joe Profaci's daughter, so he was tied into the New York families as well. He told me some crazy stories about Las Vegas and the way that they were siphoning the money and currying the money from Vegas to Detroit. They would sometimes, obviously, as you know, they would use Kansas City as a way station. He told me, you know, these were like surreal stories. I mean, him telling me about when he got busted and he had to sell the casino, talking to me about having lunch with Howard Hughes. And, you know, negotiating the deal that sold the Frontier on a napkin at a famous eatery in Las Vegas with Howard Hughes, and he kept on this guy was a billionaire and he was wearing tennis shoes. Can you believe that? The guy couldn't wear some pair of tennis shoes. He was wearing a business suit and tennis shoes.
Yeah, he was an old school. Like, he would have been an old school mob guy who would have believed that you should dress up. You don't run around with a tracksuit and a gold chain around your neck. You dress like a businessman.
All the Detroit guys, for the most part, were like that. It's only been the more recent, leadership crew that are into the jogging suits. But you would never find Tony Jackalone or Billy Jackalone or Jack Tocco or Tony Cirilli, Vince Maley or Mike Polizzi, who were the leadership of this group from the 60s into the 2000s. You never seen any of those guys in the jogging suit. These guys were all business, and that's really one of the hallmarks of the Detroit mob in general, was how the business acumen they had. It was always business before muscle. Murder and violence was always a last resort, but if they had to reach that last resort, these guys were as vicious and as stealthy about that kind of stuff as possible. There's only been one member of organized crime in Detroit ever convicted of a murder since 1931, and there's only been one member of the Detroit mob to ever turn government informant in that same 80-year period. It just speaks to the stability of this group and how they do business. Yeah, they were smack dab in the middle of all the Las Vegas stuff. We're talking about the politics of the Detroit mob and connecting it to Vegas. Tony Cirilli was the heir apparent at that point, and his father had basically given over the family to him on a day-to-day basis in the mid-60s, and was at the time very happy with it. The Las Vegas situation, the Detroit family was just lying in their pockets, and you think about, you know, $6 million back in the 60s, that's a lot of money.
That's a lot of money.
And I'm sure there was more that they skimmed that didn't make it into that court case. But when he got busted for it, and it brought shame to the family, and it brought shame to his dad, Joe Cirilli, who I said was a member of the commission. And people looked at it as, you know, maybe the first indication that the gig was up, that, you know, the hand's been caught in the cookie jar, and the light has been shined on the fact that the mob is stealing from these casinos and are actually using front men to buy them and control them, but in the background they're the ones pulling the strings. Anyway, it would be another 20 years until Vegas was kind of ridded of that influence. But that was really the first domino to fall in terms of law enforcement's fight against the mob in Vegas. And unfortunately for Tony Z, it led to his demotion, and he got the family taken away from him by his own father. His father looked at what happened in Vegas as an indication that maybe my son isn't worthy of taking over my Borgata. Maybe it would be in better hands with my nephew. And when Tony Cirilli was in prison, I think he did his time in between Terre Haute, Indiana, and Sandstone, Minnesota, he got the family, like I said, Bill Cirilli's dad gave the family to his nephew, Jack Tocco, who was Tony Cirilli's first cousin and best friend. And that caused a lot of animosity and tension that lasted for decades, to the point, I'm going to tie this all around back to Jimmy Hoffa, to the point when these two, let me first state that as an olive branch, when he got out of prison, Jack Tocco named Cirilli his underboss. So he said, I mean, you're not the boss anymore, but you can still be the underboss, and you basically can have you can have an unchecked authority, pretty much. He had his own crew and didn't always have to check with Jack on his day-to-day decisions. He had autonomy. But he wasn't, at the end of the day, he wasn't the boss. He was still the underboss. But the animosity that existed between these two former best friends, and they'd slept at each other's weddings and baptized each other's children, that demotion weighed heavy, like I said, for years, to the point when they were both busted in 1996 in the Operation Game Tax case, which again tied in the skimming of the Frontier, the Aladdin, and the Edgewater out in Nevada. Not Jack Tocco took what his uncle did one step further. He didn't just demote Tony Cirilli. He shelved him. He said, you're done. When you get out of prison from this sentence, which was in 2005, I believe, he said, you will no longer have any part of this family anymore. And he pulled away all of his racket. He pulled away all of his business, legitimate businesses that he had tied through the Detroit mob family. And to add insult to injury, he allegedly staged a robbery of Tony Z's house. They went in there when Tony Z was at trial. A group of guys went in there and took out his safe.
Oh, no. And, oh, that's like the cardinal sin, dude. That's bad.
And then about a week or two, or a week after Tony Z was convicted in the case, his bodyguard and protege was killed. So it was pretty dark and messy. And then when Cirilli got out, he was very adamant about trying to get back in. And there was actually I believe the last time that Tocco and Cirilli saw each other face to face would have been around, let's say, 2010 or 11. They actually had a whatever you could consider 80-year-olds had a fist fight. I'm laughing, but it's really not. It's
actually kind of
bad.
It is. You gotta laugh. Scott, you gotta laugh at that one.
They started swinging at each other in Jack Topol's driveway over the anger that Tony Z had from. Like I said, this guy, I don't know many people that had ridden as high as he had and then had fallen as low as he had. He was broke financially, emotionally, and it won. And to the point now, I'm going to tie it all back together, to the point that in 2013, Tony Z went to the FBI and told them that they could find Jimmy Hoffa's body on Jack Topol's property.
Oh.
So he committed the ultimate sin.
Ultimate.
He was so angry about it that, you know, that was his trump card. And I think he kept on threatening that through the years after he'd got out of my prison. Before he did that, he was telling Jack, you know, either let me back in, give me some of my rackets back, or I'm going to the feds. And then he eventually did. Now, fortunately for Jack Toko, they dug up the property and they didn't find anything. And the whole story really begins with the first bust of the mob skimming Las Vegas in the late 60s,
yeah,
with Tony Z stealing $6 million from the Frontier. And then the end of that story was 2013. Tony Z, who was the guy in public trouble, Jack Toko, who at the time had been the godfather of the Detroit Mafia since the late 70s, under the bus.
You know, and as an aside to that story about the mob skimming at the Aladdin in the late 70s, that first started coming out. Well, I've got some wiretaps here of Joe Augusto talking to our underboss, Carl DeLuna, and he was like Kansas City's man. Joe Augusto was like Kansas City's man,
yeah,
in Vegas, and he worked in the Tropicana. Tropicana, the owners were wanting to sell it or sell off a big piece of it. And also the Stardust was going up for sale. So they were trying to put together a combination. Now that I'm thinking about it, they were trying to put together one combination that would be subservient to Kansas City family to buy the Stardust from Alan Glick. And they got some of the owners of the Tropicana to say, yeah, we'd be partners in that. And they knew who they were dealing with, but they had plausible deniability. But then Joe's telling Tuffy, he said, you know, he said, they're getting scared, Gustafson and the woman out there, Mitzi Stauffer-Briggs, and the Dumonte brothers, who are all these kind of partial owners in different casinos, were putting this combination together to buy that. They got scared when they saw the Aladdin thing go down, and they started reporting in the newspapers about the connections back to the Detroit family and how the U.S. Attorney's Office was going to start looking into that, and they really continued on to looking into that. So they just backed off, and they just dropped out of that whole deal to buy the Stardust. So it had like even more far-reaching effects.
It's interesting, and it's kind of an anomaly when it comes to Detroit, because Detroit, in so many ways, is so ahead of the curve.
Yeah, they were
business, but they were, you know, they're so well versed at white collar business, and so much more so, at least dating back further than a lot of these other families. But they were they didn't just get hit at once. They were the first family to really get hit in the first two biggest casino scams. I
mean, right, both of them.
The,
yes,
the strawman cases didn't happen until the 80s.
Right, this family, and this was the investigation of the strawman wiretaps I was listening to, but they had already been popped. So,
yeah, so the Detroit got popped twice before the other families got popped once. So.
But you know, I guess I'm thinking about Detroit really got early. They were one of the early adopters from the Midwest families into Las Vegas. And yeah, if I think back, you know, it's Jimmy Hoffa. He had all that Teamster money, and he realized those could be some decent investments, I believe. He had a lawyer named Morris Schenker from St. Louis.
Yep.
And Schenker was all involved. He's the one that I think got them all involved in Las Vegas originally. He ended up getting a loan and buying a casino himself out there.
I think one of the greatest FBI wiretap conversations of all time was caught between Morshenker and a Chicago mobster by the name of Joey the Clown Lombardo, who was the consigliere of the Chicago mob and a longtime counsel before he got convicted of a murder in 2007. But in his trial in 2007, they played a wiretap, I believe from the early 80s or late 70s, where the Chicago, where Alan Glick and Alan Dorfman, who was kind of the Teamsters, the guy that held the purse strings to the pension fund, and Alan Glick, as you know, was a frontman. They were having a conversation. Lombardo, Dorfman, and Glick were having a conversation. Or maybe Glick wasn't there. Maybe it was just Dorfman and Lombardo were having a conversation with Shanker, telling Shanker that he had to sell his shares. I believe it was at the Dunes. And Shanker was resisting, saying, you know, I'm not going to sell. And Joey Lombardo on the tape very, very, very calmly said, Morris, we've been doing business a long time. I'm trying to look out for you. How old are you now? And Lombardo said, well, if you want to make 73, you'll do what we're saying.
Yeah, that's a classic, isn't it? I've seen that. Yeah. That is a classic.
Yeah.
All you can do is spend a dollar feeding jail one day. If you don't want that, you got nothing to worry about. You don't reach 73 then.
You know, very understated in a real, and I've heard it in a really calm voice. But, you know, if you on reach 73, you'll do what I say.
I'll give another one that I saw, another kind of clip that I tied into, again, what we're talking about. One of my best mob sources, I won't reveal who it was, but he was someone that was very high up in the Detroit family. And we were talking about Jimmy Hoffa. And, the headaches that, you know, that the Detroit mob almost did too good of a job on the Hoffa hit. You know, they made the guy disappear, and no charges have ever been filed, but the case hounds these guys. And this is a family that thrives in the shadows, and they're the opposite of the way the Gambinos under John Gotti were, or the way the Philadelphia mob is now under Joey Marino, who thrive under the spotlight. These guys thrive in the shadows. The Hoffa case, the Hoffa investigation, for the FBI at least, it's almost like the gift that keeps on giving, because every year or every couple of years, the case is back in the news, and there's digs and there's searches and there's everything under the sun sitting here for over 40 years later. And again, for a family that hates being in the headlines, it just drives them crazy, and they almost lamented themselves that we did too good of a job. And Hoffa disappeared from a restaurant parking lot in a suburb of Detroit called Bloomfield Hills. It's off of a road called Telegraph Road. And this very powerful mobster in Detroit, when we were sitting down and talking about it, he said, if we had to do it all over again, we just would have left him on Telegraph Road.
Yeah, really.
Yeah, exactly. We just would have killed him and left him right there, and we wouldn't be sitting here still hearing about it 40 years later.
Yeah, I agree. Well, you know, speaking of Jimmy Hoffa, and I was kind of saving this question. We're getting on into this thing, probably about done. Give me your as a guy that has really good Detroit mob connections and FBI connections, and a media guy and a true crime author and blogger. What do you think this new movie coming out? This I heard you paint houses, and I read the book. I'm suspicious of the whole story myself, but what do you think?
Well, I have mixed feelings, just in the sense that I you know, I'm a huge fan of mob movies. Obviously, because of what I do, I can be hypercritical. I Martin Scorsese movies, in some ways. As much as I say that my interest in this started when I was in law school working cases, really the first time I ever remember hearing about the mob or seeing anything about the mob was when I was in
seventh grade, maybe. Maybe this wasn't the best version of my dad. But my dad took me, my mom was out of town, and my dad's like, we're going to see Goodfellas.
Ah,
and
one of the greatest mob movies ever. Scott, that movie, I'm going to tell you something. From my personal experience, that movie painted that picture of professional criminals who really do all the work for the mob guys and then their relationship with the made guys in the mob and how that works. That was the greatest depiction that I've ever seen.
Yeah, I agree. And the other thing I will tell people when people ask you about that, I think that not necessarily the movie Donnie Brasco, but the performance by Pacino in that movie, I think does justice of most mob guys aren't Don Corleone or Sonny Corleone or Michael Corleone. Most mob guys are like Pacino's character and Donnie Brasco.
Yeah.
Spokes on a wheel.
Yeah.
The type of guys that if they worked a normal job would probably make just as much money as as being a wise guy.
Yeah.
And I love the scene in Donnie Brasco where he gives Donnie Brasco like $1,000 for his birthday or whatever, and can I take this back? I need a loan. Gives him $1,000 in a card, and then 2 seconds later, he grabs it back and puts it in his pocket. but so I know Martin Scorsese is close to my heart, and those movies are close to my heart. And he's a genius, and the people he is doing the movies, but this specific movie with him, De Niro, Pacino, Pesci, you know, everyone's coming out of the woodwork for this. But it's going to be a colossal bastardization of the truth. and unfortunately, because of who's doing it, you know, this, I call it like a mob supergroup.
Yeah, the icons. That's a good way. Mob supergroup.
This is going to be, unfortunately, for the public, this is going to be, the record.
This is going to be the truth.
Happens.
Yeah, I agree.
In reality, this, it's just, I can't emphasize enough to your listeners, for someone that's here at Ground Zero, off of Ground Zero here in Detroit, and has studied the case, you know, probably more than most, and I've talked to people connected to it deeper than most. There is absolutely no truth to the story that Frank Sheeran was spinning in that book. Yes, was he friends with Hoffa? Yes. Was he a hitman to the mob? Yes. But every single person I've spoken to, both law enforcement, FBI, and mob guy, and I've spoken to very highly placed mobsters in both Detroit, Chicago, and Philadelphia in this. And Sheeran reported to the mob in Philly. Those were the mob in Philly and the mob in Northeast Pennsylvania were his were the guys that he directly were responsible for him. Not one person, whether we're talking mobster, ex-mobster, FBI, ex-FBI, not one person gives this credence. The house that he claims that he shot Hoffa in, the FBI and the local authorities did a very thorough DNA scrub and came back negative. And every person I've spoken to about Frank Sheeran said he was a loudmouth drunk that was a gigantic storyteller, liar, and blowhard that was trying at the end of his life, trying to make his legacy significantly bigger than it was. Was shopping around a book. I'm not going to go into specifics how I know all of this, but I know this for a fact. He was shopping around a book at the end of his life, minus the little nugget that he killed Jimmy Hoffa, and that he's also telling people in this book that he killed Joe Gallo, which is another very infamous mob hit.
Yeah, really.
In New York.
That's almost even more far-fetched.
Yeah, well, and that to me, actually, in my opinion, negates the claim that he killed Hoffa.
Yeah.
It shows that he's more of a liar. But I know for a fact that he was shopping the book. He shopped the book a number of times without those revelations in it, and then was nudged by certain people around him to add some flair into the story, and
he threw in the fact that he pulled the trigger on Jimmy Hoffa and Joe Gallo. Immediately got a book deal.
Yeah.
The book deal got on the New York Times bestsellers list. Martin Scorsese and De Niro come in and option it, and they're going to make a movie out of it. So I guess at the end of the day, business-wise, it was
a good move, yes.
But historically, it's unfortunate because it really has zero credence, and you know, most people would come away thinking that, the Hoffa case is solved. So
All right, well, that's been great, Scott. Tell us a little bit about what you're up to now. You have the Gangster Report, one of the better mob blogs on the internet. And what else are you up to?
Thank you. Now I am just finished up work on a both a Hollywood movie and a documentary that's going to be on Netflix and on cable very soon about a teenage drug dealer from Detroit in the 1980s. His name was White Boy Rick, or Richard Werfew is his real name. He was the longest serving non-violent juvenile offender in the American prison system. He's been in prison since he was 17 years old. He was quite a media sensation in the Detroit area when he was 16 or 17. He had risen very high in a Detroit drug world that was populated by all people of a different race and of age, or you know, he's a white guy, and most of the Detroit drug world was populated by African American gentlemen, and all guys that are in their you know, late 20s, early 30s. They still debate like how much of the story about him was created by the media. How big of a name was he really? And I can't really speak to. Well, I can speak and say that, you know. I wouldn't call him a kingpin by any imagination, but he was a 17-year-old kid that was moving in very fast circles with very high-profile, dangerous people, and that and for a 16, 17-year-old white kid to move in those circles and bounce around town in the kind of flashy clothing. He liked to wear mink coats, and then he started dating the mayor of Detroit's niece. which added fuel to the fire. It was a very, I guess you'd call it, sexy story back in the day, and he was convicted on a single cocaine possession charge in the first couple weeks of 1988, and has been locked up ever since. And he just got paroled from the state of Michigan after 30 years. Now he's finishing up a short sentence that he has to do down in Florida. So the story that not a lot of people knew about until I came on the scene about 10 years ago, reporting about his case, was that he was actually a product of the U.S. government, and that the FBI and the DPD and the DEA that were all part of a federal drug task force, and trying to bring down the mayor of Detroit, actually, a guy by the name of Coleman Young, the first black mayor of any major American city. He ruled Detroit with an iron fist for 20 years. Very divisive, very fiery character, and never convicted, but a lot of people believe that he was very corrupt. And his niece was married to a very big drug dealer. And the FBI thought they could use, at that time, a 14-year-old white kid to surreptitiously feed them information. They basically hired him right out of eighth grade and sent him into this drug organization, with their ultimate goal being to nail the drug dealer, flip the drug dealer, and then have the drug dealer flip on there. That's not what happened. What did happen was the 14-year-old, in a matter of a couple months, rose to be the drug kingpin's right-hand man, and like a almost like an ornament or a mascot, this 28, 29-year-old superfly driving around in his Mercedes enjoyed having the 14-year-old mop-topped Leave It to Beaver in his Mercedes next to him, and with a gold chain. He thought it looked kind of, you know, for whatever reason.
White Boy Rick was just one more ornament around his neck, yeah. Sounds like, on his gold chain.
Yeah, so then White Boy Rick ended up giving these guys enough information to bust the drug dealer. The drug dealer went went to prison, and the government kind of cut off, I mean, kind of, the government cut off ties with white boy Rick Wershe, and Wershe continued on in the drug trade and ended up taking the drug kingpin's wife, who was the mayor's niece. And he was, at the time, he was 16, the niece was 24, and, you know, a different race, and it, again, it just took, it took the media spotlight, you know, it just took it into a whole other level, and he was plastered on the television and on the newspaper headlines for a good year and a half, 2 years. Then it was kind of forgotten about, and then I came on the scene about 20 years into his, prison sentence, and started to write about kind of the story that people didn't know about it. Everyone knew that he was this 16, 17-year-old flashy drug dealer, but no one really knew about the fact that he had been working for the government between 14 and 16. And I was able to come in and verify that and confirm that and start creating a new narrative that luckily picked up a lot of steam, and the case got out of Detroit and got national, got international. A lot of people started writing about it. Hollywood got interested in it. So there's a Hollywood film coming out in January with Matthew McConaughey.
Matthew McConaughey is going to be White Boy Rick.
No, Matthew McConaughey is going to play White Boy, or plays White Boy Rick's dad.
Okay, all right, go ahead.
And then they have a an unknown 15-year-old that they plucked out of a trailer park in Baltimore.
Oh, you know, that's right. Matthew McConaughey'd be a little old to play teenage drug dealer, wouldn't he? But interesting, you got a big name associated with it. Well, that's cool.
Yeah, so that movie will be out in January, and then the documentary that I executive produced, which will be kind of the real story, next to the Hollywoodized story, will be actually coming out the same day in January, and we're actually the premiere that the movie's called White Boy Rick. The documentary is just called White Boy. The film will premiere January 26th. And the documentary, we're going to be premiering at the New York Film Festival next week. And then it will be on cable and on streaming services the same week that the film comes out.
Great. And is that Seth Ferrante from St. Louis help you with that one?
Yeah.
You worked with Seth.
Yeah, so Seth Ferrante was kind of the seed that grew into the documentary. He was the one that had the idea about doing a
It's a companion piece.
Companion piece documentary with the film. Yeah. And he had a previous relationship with this documentarian by the name of Sean Reck, who's one of the fastest rising documentarians in the country. Has done just amazing work on his first three documentaries. It's getting a lot of buzz in Hollywood, and people are kind of calling him the next Michael Moore, the next Harold Morris, Warner Herzog type storytellers. And Seth connected us with Sean, and we're very happy with the product. And I think a lot of people, I think sometimes you got to wait, you know, a movie comes out, and then you got to kind of, maybe if there is a documentary, maybe it comes out later. Or maybe you have to do some digging to find out what the real story is. I know I always, backtracking for a second, right after I saw Goodfellas and right after I saw Donnie Brasco, I ran out. I wanted to buy the book. I wanted to read the real story.
Yeah.
I think it's good timing-wise that the documentary is going to come out the same time as the film. I know that on the cable, they might be running them close together, and so you might be able to watch the movie and then watch the documentary on the same channel at some point. So
there's some little clips on YouTube, or there, I think if you go to YouTube White Boy Rick or Rick Wershe, I spell that last name.
It's Wershe, W-E-R-S-H-E.
Okay, Rick Wershe. Check that on YouTube. There's some information there, and of course, on Scott's website, on your blog site, there's going to be information.
Yeah. So my gangster, my website is www.gangsterreport.com. I like to kind of think of it as a online magazine akin to the way that Rolling Stone magazine reports about music, I like to take my website as akin to the way that I report about the underworld. It's not just straight mob stuff. It's mob stuff mixed with pop culture and politics and history, movies and television, all kind of rolled up into one. I don't want to really be pigeonholed as, reporting hardline mob stuff, because that's kind of, it's a very specific market who I love, for those people that buy my books and stuff. But I like trying to kind of expand the perspective and give people kind of a unique lens to look through when we're talking about, mobsters and drug dealers and people like that, because there are always a lot of connections to pop culture. I mean, like I said, sitting with Tony Zerilli in his house in Florida and going over, his photo collection. I mean, just looking at, photos with Sinatra and Dean Martin and Sammy Davis Jr. and Connie Francis, and amazing stories about, the connections. And I'm sure a lot of these guys have connections to those type of people. And I had some great stories when I was in Chicago, when I was doing research for my Chicago book. And I've written a little bit about this. James Caan, Sonny Corleone.
Yeah.
He was in Chicago doing a movie back in the early 80s called Thief, which was kind of a precursor to Heat. Michael Mann,
right,
who did Heat, did Thief, and Thief is like in some way the companion film, with James Caan kind of playing the Robert De Niro character younger.
Yep.
And I was talking to the next FBI agent. They told me a great story that I ended up writing off. Article about on my website about how they caught a con on a wire, on a mob wire, because he was connected to a lot of guys through friends and whatnot. And he had told this very prolific mob burglary crew that he was going to go with them on a job.
Oh, boy.
And the FBI intercepted him coming out of a hotel about to go meet these guys. And they said, "Jimmy, we know where you're going. And if you end up going there, you're going to be in a handcuff end of the night. Stay away. We're not going to let you go on this." And I actually had that in my book. My book was Odd Penguin. And Penguin didn't let me, didn't think that it was verified enough to put that in my book.
Yeah.
So I had to write about it on my website. But,
interesting.
I had faith in that. I had three different FBI agents tell me the same thing. So I trusted their recollection.
Yeah.
And let me just give one more anecdote before we get off the phone.
Okay.
I think demonstrates a little bit about how to interact with mobsters. So I've had a couple interactions with the mob boss of Detroit, a guy by the name of Jackie Jackalone, whose father was Vito Billy Jack Jackalone, and whose uncle was Tony Jack Jackalone. And the Jackalone brothers were the face of the Detroit mob on the streets from the late 1950s into the 2000s. It was maybe a couple months after my first book came out. Jackalone lives, most of the Italians of Detroit live on the east side of town. I'm Jewish. I grew up on the west side of town where most of the Jews live. But there are, there are some Italians that live on the west side, and Jack Jackalone is one of the Italians that lived on the west side, so occasionally we'd run into each other at Starbucks or Best Buy or stuff like that. And Jack is someone who's just like his dad, Vito, very, very weary of possible law enforcement surveillance, and won't really hold meetings unless he's a big fan of the walk and talks.
Yeah.
And he would have people, meet him throughout the day at the various public places and just, walk and discuss. Doesn't have like a central office. His dad was famous for holding meetings in meat lockers.
It would be a good one.
That
electronic equipment doesn't work well in zero temperature.
Him and his dad owned a produce company, and they had these big, giant meat lockers in there. And everyone knew if you were having a meeting with, if you had a meeting with Billy Jack, you got to bring your parka. So I was in line at Barnes & Noble buying a book or a magazine, I don't remember. And I turned to the break, and I saw Jack Jackalone
who at that time was the street boss. He wasn't the, I got to him and I introduced myself. And I talked to him for, I don't know, 2-3 minutes. I mean, he's not someone who will talk shop with me.
Yeah.
But he'll well, some will, but he's not someone who will talk shop with me, but he'll you know, have small talk. You know, did you see the Tiger game last night? How's your family? How's your daughter? How's your dad? Stuff like that. So after I introduced myself to Jack Lilly and we parted ways, I later heard that he called some members of his crew and said, yeah, you'll never believe this author Bernstein just came up to me, man. This kid's really got some ball. And he wasn't saying it in a derogatory way. He was saying it like, you know, can you believe this kid, you know, like he got out from behind his computer and he actually wanted to interact with me. And I think, I don't want to say that he respects me because I wouldn't go that far and I have no idea if he does or if he doesn't.
Yeah.
But I found it interesting or kind of a portal into interviewing the way maybe the way some of these guys react to that kind of stuff when I had two different members of his crew that actually kind of relayed to me that within like, you know, seconds.
Yeah, oh, really?
Leaving him, he jumped on the phone and was like, this Bernstein kid, this 29-year-old kid's got some balls, and he's not afraid to come up and introduce himself to me. So
really,
I always think that kind of was a way to, I kind of made my bones.
Yeah.
By not being afraid to interact with the people that I was writing about.
Yeah, interesting. Well, this has been great, Scott. I really appreciate you doing this interview with me. It will help with my media and the mob series. I know people will be interested in, you know, they're interested in the mob and they read your stuff and they follow different reporters now. They can find out what y'all have to go through to get that good information. And so tell us what you got out there that people might want to go to find out more about you and your book and that kind of thing. Then we'll get out of here.
So I've had 5 books published in the last 10 years. They can all be found on Amazon or anywhere books are sold. Two of them have been about Detroit, one about Chicago, one about Philadelphia, and then one is an ebook that I go region by region around North America, and I list the top 5, in my opinion, the top 5 most significant gangland hits in every major city in North America.
Oh, interesting.
Going back to Prohibition into the 2000s, and I go into Canada, do a little Montreal, do Toronto, and then do all the major cities in America, in the United States. So those are the 5 books.
So those are going to be on your website, www.gangsterreport.com. And if a person went to Amazon and just searched for Scott Bernstein.
Scott Bernstein, Bernstein.
Yeah, they'll find him. Okay, great.
I've been an executive producer and talking head on a number of documentaries that my name is also attached to that you can find on Amazon, as well as on iTunes and Netflix and Amazon Prime.
Yeah.
And then I have this, as we talked about earlier, I have my new documentary coming out called White Boy, which will be on iTunes and streaming in January. You can go check the Hollywood film out on January 26th with Matthew McConaughey, where I was the film's official technical and script consultant, kind of keeping their history, in terms of what the story they were telling, keeping some of their history intact. And then you can, reach me over Twitter at twitter.com at Bernie's Tweets, BURNEYSTWEETS. And like I said, get me at my website, or you can find me on Facebook, Scott Bernstein, BURNSTEIN. And I love interacting with people, love talking to fans of my work, as well as just fans of the genre in general. And I appreciate you giving me the time to come on and talk to you.
Great. And folks, if you've got some kind of like interesting little mob story that you would think Scott might be interested in, get hold of him. He's I approached him early on when I started doing this blogging and my movie and
podcast, and he's real approachable, and so, and he's always looking for new material. I know that. I know I always am, yep, too. So I always ask people to, you know, give me suggestions and interact with me. So you can do that with Scott too. So I really appreciate you being here, Scott. It's been great talking to you, and we will continue to be in touch, I'm sure, over the years.
Thanks, Gary, man. Love what you guys do. Love what you're doing, man.
All right, Scott. Goodbye.
Thanks, buddy.
Talk to you later.
Music provided by Odd-O-Matic. Follow them on Twitter at Odd-O-Matic Music.
On the advice of my lawyer, I respectfully refuse to answer that question, as my truthful answer may tend to incriminate me.